Hello, welcome to Startup Kitchen Talk, where we talk about innovation apprentices becoming master chefs. And sometimes, in this case, master chefs can burn the kitchen down. It's because sometimes the big tech players can misunderstand the market, especially the ones that they don't live in. To talk about emerging markets and their specifics, please welcome Marek Aldorf, Senior Program Manager at United Nations. Welcome.
Hi.
Let's start with the dirty laundry. Talk me about the Bangladesh market and the washing machines.
That's an interesting use case. So basically, it's one of the nice examples of international companies coming to a local emerging markets, not really understanding the fundamentals, right? Just looking at the high-level economics that people can actually afford, white appliances, washing machines, dishwashers, and so on, but not taking into consideration local aspects such as, you know, flooding or rodents. So, you know, they were confused why it's not selling that much, because
You mean the classic companies like Electrolux, Bosch?
Yeah, Bosch and others. Yes. They were confused, like, why it's not like selling as good, because the people should have the money. The issue there was that a lot of the people actually wanted to buy these products had issues with flooding or mice, you know, eating the cables. That's why they prolong or, you know, were really waiting for different product that is fit to the market. And one of the companies, I cannot remember which one, actually say, hey, we can do small innovation. And they put like plastic coverings on these white appliances so mice cannot eat the cables. And it can withstand like small amount of flooding, right? A couple of centimeters. And then suddenly, you know, they won the market.
Okay, well, when you focus on quantum 3D hyperwheel vortex engines with neuroclean nanobubbles, you might forget about floods and rats.
Exactly.
How often does this happen?
I think it happens often because, you know, in my experience, a lot of companies from all around the world, they think of Africa or other, you know, like emerging markets as one entity, right? But it has like, you know, many populations, many geographies, many different culture and other aspects that you need to take into account, right? Not only like who buys your product and how they use it, but also what can be the consequences of it. And a lot of companies, they don't do proper due diligence. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, when you have these bad results.
Speaking of consequences, the unintentional ones, they can get more serious. We've got the plastic pollutions made by those small Coca-Cola and Unilever bottles in Indonesia, in Philippines. We've got the Nestle case introducing the baby formula, which led to children malnutrition. How does this happen? Like that the management doesn't see this coming and overlooks?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, known unknowns and unknown unknowns, right? So, for example, in case of you know, Unilever you know, selling the pack like super small packages, so it's affordable. I think it's like rational economic thinking that people can actually afford finally your product. But what they did not take into account is there is no infrastructure to actually get rid of all the plastics, right? Mm-hmm. Because they say, okay, people can finally afford. That's the plus. But the minus is there is not the infrastructure behind it.
And the question is, do they care?
I hope they do. Not sure they always do. But that's the thing, right? You need to look on these markets more holistically, not just in terms of who can afford the product, but how they use it, but also in what environment or what's the infrastructure around it, like the services,
the context.
Right? Exactly. Can it be disposed of, or does it have like any health hazards? Because the use is a little bit different in, let's say, country X in Africa than Denmark, for example.
Do we have examples of the slightly the other way around, when something was introduced with one purpose and but people turn its hat on its hat and use it completely other way?
One of the nice examples is the Axiom game, which is the pay to earn type of games based on the Web3 technologies, which was supposed to incentivize players to play the game to earn a couple of dollars a day by earning these specialized like tokens.
Smooth love potions,
right? And it The intention was good, right? It was like a novel approach. The issue was that, I think it was in the Philippines, people start using it as the main source of income, right? They basically quit their jobs and they were earning these couple of dollars a day through that game. The issue then became that sometimes you have to buy some, let's say, like levels to level mm-hmm. up and earn more. So you go into debt, right? You need to buy the computer, better connection, and so on. So you can go into debt to actually, you know, start earning. But then the company can get hacked and everybody loses their family earned savings,
yeah.
like life savings. Or basically the value just stops because the company stops producing the game or supporting the game.
And that is because of the lack of education, or just who is here to blame? Is the company or the government, the lack of regulation, or is it just that happens?
I think it's like that happens, but like when it happens, what we need to measure is the reaction, let's say, of the government and the producer of that tool, right? It's when, let's say, the company discovers, okay, a lot of players are actually using it to earn money. They need to be more careful, for example, how they store their information or that their, mm-hmm. let's say, crypto wallets are protected, because it's, you know, let's say, family earnings for a lot of them.
For smooth love potions, is there something that the startups can learn from that for all those cases of unintentional consequences?
I think you can like really learn that you need to do your due diligence, and not only once before you launch the product, but also like as you are on the market, right? To really look for how the product is used, what they use it for. And then if something happens, to work, you know, either with the community or with the government or NGOs to make sure there is either education or some, let's say, better regulation in order for people not to get exploited if that is the case.
Let's talk more about the opportunities the emerging market present. It's one small step for a man, one giant leapfrog mankind. What is leapfrogging and where do we see it?
Well, leapfrogging is almost like everywhere currently in emerging mm-hmm. markets. Basically, you know, in the past, they were a little bit lagging technologically behind mm-hmm. Behind the developed world in terms of infrastructure, really, like internet, finance, banking, and others. Which means now they don't have this like legacy infrastructure, mm-hmm. which to some extent was, you know, bad because they couldn't build on it. But now they can leapfrog, meaning they can just, you know, get rid of the legacy shackles mm-hmm. of technologies we use, right? One of the examples could be the fintech, which is, you know, I think in some aspects ahead, in, for example, in many African countries, ahead of Europe or the US or Asia, that, for example, you have local merchants, that they have applications where they can directly sell to the customers and they don't need any terminal. It's like tap to merchant, right? Yeah. They just use the NFCs. But like here, either you go to the bank if you're a merchant, or you still have this, you know, device where you need to scan the card, right? This is still like, for us, it's like innovation, but it's still like legacy innovation, right? Okay. They don't have need for this.
And how was with the internet? How do they solve the issue of not having full coverage?
Well, you know, the emerging markets, or if you speak more concretely about Africa, it's like a huge region, right? So you have regions mm-hmm. within Africa which has like excellent connectivity, but you have regions where there is like limited. So a lot of the technologies that you apply there, for example, with fintech, it needs to address the local variations. So most of the time you need technology that can work on low bandwidth, right? So you don't need a lot of fancy graphics. Mm-hmm. It can do a lot of, let's say, features or, let's say, computations on your phone, right? So it doesn't need to connect to the cloud. And then you have also a lot of applications that basically work that you just like download the content mm-hmm. once, if you are like near a hotspot, and then use the content afterwards.
And is there something people, Europe, US, Asia, would be shocked to learn about the leapfrogging? What is the one thing you would highlight?
I really think like the fintech is ahead, right? They have these like super applications. You know, like in China, you have WeChat, mm-hmm. But in Africa, you have also this like Flutterwave, mm-hmm. Orange. Something, I'm not sure like what that name is, and many other applications that basically can give you like microloan, you can pay like through text, you can get insurance, you know, you can order like host of like different like financial services, just like within a couple of seconds on your phone, right? But for now, if you want to get microloan in Czech Republic, you still need, you know, jump through a lot of hoops with the bank or with, you know, startups like Zonky. Maybe it's not a startup, right? But it can take days or weeks. But a lot of these, let's say, fintech applications, especially in Africa, they can, let's say, give you microloan within a couple of minutes on really limited amount of information about you. That there is like a delinquency or, you know, some like indebtedness, there's like, there's the collateral. But technologically, they are, you know, in many aspects ahead.
And who creates this innovation? Is that because there's a lot of illiteracy? I can't imagine like everybody could know how to code. Because nowhere in the world is it so. And who is the tech innovators, and how good they are?
Now you have many hubs, right? Like in Africa, it's like 1.5 billion people, so there are a lot of like great coders. And you are, you have like a lot of emerging like technology hubs, like Nigeria, you know, Kenya, South Africa is still strong, Rwanda or, you know, Senegal. They are coming up like pretty strong. And you have a lot of local founders that are behind this. There is still a question like how well they can like finance or scale, right? Because the VC arena is not as big as in Europe or the US. But you have many cases that you actually have like African founders, but they found a startup in, let's say, the US, in San Francisco, where they get the structure, right? Like the drive, like the VC funding, but they apply the technology in back in Africa.
Oh, really?
Which is, I think, the case, for example, from Flutterwave, like one of the biggest fintech startups. I think the people behind are from Nigeria.
We mentioned the internet coverage. So what is the core medium used for entertainment and information?
It's like hard to, it differs like region by region, right? But for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there is internet penetration is, let's say, strong around like bigger cities, but like very low in remote regions, right? So there's like a huge difference even locally.
So let's talk about the rural remote regions.
If you talk about remote regions, then there is, let's say, a lot of people have smartphones, but there is a issue with the connectivity, right? So as I mentioned, a lot of people use smartphone, but they, let's say, use it to download content when they are near hotspot. And then they come home and they, you know, use the content or do the stuff with the smartphone. But in the remote regions, like the primary medium is often actually radio, because it's, you know, actually infrastructure-wise cheap to broadcast, you know, to large vast distances, and it's the, you know, the technology for radio itself is super simple and it's cheap, right? So, and people don't have TVs that much,
so nor the video or the internet killed the radio star.
Exactly. And then also, you know, printed media also are not that big because you have logistics issue, right? You cannot, it's like thousands of kilometers, you know, around, so it's hard to actually let's say print something and then drive it to remote areas.
And radio focused is your project in United Nations as well, right?
It's one of the projects we have.
So tell me, why should United Nations care about the radio in rural places of Africa?
Got it. Well, the matter is really simple, right? United Nations has many offices across all the, you know, emerging countries, especially in some African countries, where it has peacekeeping missions, right? And a lot of UN agencies are present there. But because, as you mentioned, the internet connectivity is low, print media or TV is not actually there that much. So radio is the primary source of information. And it's not only serves to inform the public, but also, let's say, public calls the radios, right? For example, that there was a flood and bridge collapse, right? So people call the radio and tell it, and then
instead of tweeting it, they call
it. They can call the radio, and then hope, you know, someone, let's say, in the capital or in the cities around can hear it and then send the help. So for United Nations, but also like other stakeholders, it's very important to understand what's actually discussed on the radio, right? Because that's the tool, which public tool that, which, you know, you can listen to and understand what people are saying, what's happening on the ground. The issue, though, is that it's often in local languages, which, you know, international personnel don't understand, right? Yeah. Or even a company, right? If you come in a company, you don't speak Bambara in Mali. And we try to develop systems which can automate this, right? So you, not only you can listen to, let's say, dozens or hundreds of radios or monitor it, but also you can understand it, meaning, you know, the AI helps you to transcribe and translate the languages. And then you can use it for many use cases for humanitarian and political purposes.
And how many languages and dialects are we talking about? Like, are we talking hundreds, thousands?
Now we talk hundreds, but potentially or in the future, thousands of languages, right? It's very vast amount of different communities speaking local languages. So some languages, like, I don't know, Swahili or Bambara can be speak by millions or tens of millions of people. But then you have languages that are spoken only by a couple of hundreds of thousands of people.
So this project started with LLMs or even before?
Even before. It's like a long-term project because this issue was
but here for... But in that case, there has to be a person listening to two radios simultaneously.
Yes. So basically you had to prioritize, right? Yeah. You need to have a lot of like local translators, but it could be done, but it was a lot of... it was demanding for human power.
Mm-hmm.
One, you couldn't scale it that quickly. And there was also the time lag, right? Before actually getting the translation to actually, you know, actionable insight into, you know, be able to make the decision when it's translated to one of the...
There is a bridge collapsing. We need to send help.
Yeah. And then you need to, you know, listen for it. Someone needs to listen for it, transcribe it, then...
Call the people,
right? So it takes time.
It takes time.
And you can also have that they were not listening to the radio at that particular time, right? So they missed it. And we needed to wait for a couple of hours when it was like repeated at the like evening news.
You mentioned the Bambara language. There is more that we've talked about before. It's Wolof, it's Pashto, and there is tens of thousands, tens of millions of people talking in those languages. Yet there is a lack of the digital footprint. There is a lot of YouTube videos. There is lack of data to train the models on. How do you handle that?
Exactly. Yeah, there is lack of data. And like, it's not just Africa, right? Like, it's around the world, lot of languages. And the issue, you're exactly right, that when you train these models, it's intensive in terms of, you know, computing power, electricity, connectivity. So the bigger corporations that started with the LLMs, they trained on the available data sets, right? So it's mainly from...
English.
English, Spanish, right? Yeah. Chinese, Arabic, like these type of languages. And then you can do a lot of dialects. But when you have these smaller ones and without anything digital, it's super hard to do. So what you can do are two things. One is you can hire an army of people. And basically you tell them you need to start creating this digital content, meaning you have a couple of hundreds of volunteers and they tell you, basically you record their audio, like reading sentences, right? In different, like the same sentence, but in different, let's say, like dialects, you know, women, men, children, young, old, right?
Almost so
you
have the Champollion way, yes.
Exactly. But you have like tens of or hundreds of thousands of like different like words or sentences. Mm-hmm. You get this audio
library,
right? Then you annotate it, the data, and then you train the model. But it's very people, money, and time consuming. Mm-hmm. It can take, you know, months and years, most likely, and it's never perfect. There is also like a middle way that we are trying to attempt, which is because we have a technology that can, you know, monitor or like analyze the radios, radio broadcasting. So even though we don't understand the language, we can record the language and then have it, let's say, transcribe manually from that and
so
then
train it. You're using the radio to record, then create the language model so you can understand the radio.
Exactly. But the issue is
chicken and egg situation.
Chicken and egg. But it's actually never perfect because the amount of data you need is like enormous. So you can get to a certain level, right? So some languages, when we work on them, the word error rate can be, you know, 30-40% even after like a year of trying. You will never achieve in, you know, reasonable amount of time like perfection like you have in English or Spanish. But you can get to a point where the system actually understands the basic words. So you can, let's say, understand that if they speak, let's say, about a topic of interest, the system can actually say, okay, this is the topic of interest, but then mm-hmm. you need the human in the loop to say, okay, this is correct.
Yeah.
But you can already like make like pre-analyze with the AI parts of the communication.
And how about misinformation? How often is that on the radio?
Hmm.
Like comparing to the internet, for example, do people trust the radio more than they trust social media, or is there a problem with misinformation as well? Because I can imagine that if you say that the bridge collapsed, you send the help there while you would need it elsewhere, that could cause an issue.
Well, mis- and disinformation or hate speech, right? It's issue everywhere. I wouldn't dare to say like what is, you know, quick or worse, but it's like a rat race, right? Mm-hmm. It's on the internet, it spreads more quickly because you can, you know, you can fake audio, you can fake video, you can fake images and text, right? On radio, yeah, you can also, you know, mislead in terms of like what you say, but also, for example, what you broadcast, right? You say, okay, this is, you know, recording of this person saying it. It can be deepfake, which is like very hard to understand. And the trust of the public...
Or you can just call with false information on purpose.
Exactly. But the trust in for these different mediums very varies on the region, right? So mm-hmm. you cannot say, again, as a bundle. And it's going back to the like the market problem, right? There is still like, you know, how does it work with Africa or like this region? Now, you have like dozens of different countries. Every country is a little bit different. So you can say for this particular country, this works like this.
Yeah.
And then you can go from there.
Fragmented country. We know that from Europe. Could you... give me one use case, let's say, not the bridge collapsing, but one use case, how can UN help when you will have this product, this radio and language models ready? What is a situation that this project can then help?
Yeah. Well, the potential use cases are... you know, very broad. It can be, for example, humanitarian, meaning exactly something happens, like there is a flood, something happened, and there is, you know, the roads are inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is, let's say, in the city radio, they can call it, and then, you know, someone can come from UN agency or government, anyone. You can also have, you know, like a, what's the word I'm looking for? You can also, let's say, there is an event coming which might become violent, right? There is, let's say, upcoming demonstration, right? So basically, now, okay, something is coming, you know, something is like brewing. So we can say, okay, we can prepare for that. So you can make sure that the population where this event will happen, you know, has resources for, let's say, like public order, so to speak.
Peacekeeping.
Yeah, you can send the peacekeepers, but you can also tell local police to go there, right? But then also you have like instances of hate speech. And this is what happened in Rwanda, right, in 1994. Basically, the primary orders to try to kill part of the other ethnicity was transmitted to radio, right? It was like the kill the cockroaches, right? It was the ultimate like order, like now you can do it, right? So if you monitor the public radio and you look for these type of issues, you can say, okay, this is bad, you know, there is like a hate speech against certain like community, and then you can take steps to de-escalate, right? You can look if the actor spreading is, you know, like more if it's like, let's say, one radio station, if it's multiple, right? If it's also transpired like from radio to the internet, or if it's, you know, coming from internet to the radio.
Yeah.
But then you can also say, okay, we need to de-escalate in terms of we need to, you know, try educate more the local population, you know, create, I don't know, workshops or some like more nation building exercise in that country.
Yeah, no large language model in Rwanda in 94. Mr. Beast and other YouTubers, we see that now, like, there's a burst of it. They grow their numbers with this AI dubbing, right? Mm. In Hindi, in Arabic, in Chinese, etc. Is that something that UN can do in the future, use those language models to even produce some more content?
Definitely. And I think, like, everybody can use it, right? It's even now, like, when you have an application you develop for users in Europe, you usually say, okay, it will be available in Czech, English, and German or French, right? In the near future, I believe you can just, you know, the developers will just, you know, integrate library, and they will have, like, 200, 300 languages, you know, ready to go from the application. So they are not bound by the language barrier. So I think even if you are messaging as a company or international organizations, you will, let's say something once in French, and it will be instantly translated to like hundreds of local languages.
Like, they can create problems of their own. I mean, United Nations, that's 193, I just checked, 193 countries. How do that many, and we are talking Turkey, Denmark, China, United States, how do they decide what innovation do they need?
That's like question hard to answer, but what I would say is, you know, United Nations, they have, you know, has like dozens of these member states. Not always these member states agree on everything, but they agree on still on a lot of things. And you have different fora to discuss different topics. In terms of innovation, right, you can talk about, you know, how to discuss innovation or AI regulation on global scale. That's like a whole, you know, set of different competing arguments occurring on multiple levels. But then also you have, let's say, how to tackle innovation, let's say, in peacekeeping. So, for example, what United Nations does is there is so-called peacekeeping ministerial conference. This year it was in Berlin in May, where most of the member states come in and they discuss, you know, how best to conduct peacekeeping for the next couple of years, right? And then different people or different countries can commit to different types of support, right? Some countries like, okay, we will put funding towards specific innovation in specific regions because we think it's valuable, right? It can be to exactly support, you know, logistics to remote regions. It can be, you know, to support
apolitical something.
Something like apolitical, right? Basically to really help people on the ground, right? It can be, you know, something with like drone logistics. It can be, you know, telemedicine related, right? Or it can be, for example, how to better, you know, protect the peacekeepers or build the bases, be more sustainable, right? So basically the countries come at one place and they basically discuss, you know, what can be done, what are the lessons learned from the past couple of years, what innovations are actually upcoming or show the best promise, and then they, you know, agree on the best course of action, and then the UN actually, you know, go and does.
So what is the time frame? You mentioned that the radio, talking specifically about the radio project, you mentioned that it was founded and kicked off even before the models. So it means, you know, it's 2020 something or 2010 something.
Yeah. No, the timelines were like based on the technology, but in the case of, let's say, monitoring the radios, it has been in the works for the past, you know, like 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm, okay.
But because there is like
still a newbie then.
Like a newbie, like in terms of like global organization, like a timeline, it's still like super newbie, it's like a newborn. Yes. But the thing is, you know, we are also now like going through like rapid change, let's in the AI or language models, right? When the project started, there were like LLMs, but they were like small, really non-effective. And if you were, you know, trying to analyze the broadcasting, you could get like keyword search, right? Like you could teach the computer or the system to just like highlight specific keywords, right? But not the whole sentences. Yeah. And there was almost like no support for like regional languages. You had to do it everything on your own. So it was really time and money consuming. But like in 2022, right, like the OpenAI came with like ChatGPT, and then suddenly you could use, you know, a lot of other related tools to train the models much more quickly. Something like other companies started to be interested in regional languages, right? Like not the low resource languages, but like Swahili, mm-hmm. different types of Arabic, which also helped. But then a lot of, for example, like local players, like local technical universities, right? Like started to develop their own language models, like as a, like a pilots, but you can still cooperate with them and, you know, see how that goes.
And how do you judge the success of such a project? I guess it's not like, you know, 10x ARR metrics. So how do you do that? Can you say in my maybe at 5 more years, was that successful or wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you can measure it in multiple ways. Like with our projects, we can, for example, measure like the actions taken based on the project, right? For example, how many, let's say, lives could be potentially saved because the UN office reacted based on the information gotten from the radio, right? Some things are very
on time,
hard. Exactly. Some things are very hard to quantify, especially in the humanitarian space. But like the actions, you can quantify to some extent. But you can also quantify, for example, the usage, right? If let's say the peacekeeping missions start using, you know, the technology in its reporting, right? Then it goes through the chain. So you can say, okay, it's a success because they use tool that provides another piece of informational puzzle, which should go and make the decision-making more holistic and hopefully better. But then you can also measure it is, you know, who else is using the technology, meaning not just the monitoring for the radios, but it can be the language model itself. Right, it can be other UN agencies, right? It can be like in the future outside. So, and then it can go like commercial and open the doors to startups, local or international ones that can actually build on what we built and then provide more economic.
And that's in the pipeline that you could open the doors for
the
private
intent,
sector?
Definitely, that's the intent. And UN is trying to go more open source with its technologies. And basically,
everybody says that at the beginning, though.
Yes. But we are bound to. So
maybe some will deliver.
Yeah, exactly.
Talking about startups, we slightly touched the subject before, but I wanted to ask, do you think that they, even fragmented as the emerging markets can be, do you think that local, and now I'm talking C startups, European startups, American startups, and the VCs should take more look and should give this emerging market more focus?
No, definitely, right? It's one, there is, you know, a huge amount, like hundreds of million people not covered with many services, right? Because the infrastructure is lacking, as we discussed. So you can help leapfrog in some areas, from in different regions and like different industries. So that's one. Second is because you have this like untapped market, you can be like the first or second provider of a product actually there, right? Emerging markets are developing rapidly, like at a different pace, but developing rapidly. So, you know, if there is, let's say, infrastructure not there this year, it can be next year, right? So you can actually, if you don't focus on it now, you can actually lose the train because it goes like so fast. The competition might be actually harder, let's say, in Europe or Asia or America it's more saturated market, but the competition is huge. Here, the competition might not be that strong in some industries, that's one, but also it can help you to innovate more because it can help you to think a little bit outside of the box and maybe you will figure something interesting.
And the tech talent is there. We met in the space industry in 2019, I think, that is when you were working in Prague, then you moved to New York, you worked in the startup industry, and you started in United Nations there. So I wanted to ask, space industry, startup industry, or United Nations, where are the most idealistic people?
I can actually say that, you know, the space industry and United Nations have like this, I think, the same amount of people that are like idealistic.
The dreamers.
Reach for the stars. Yeah.
Save people.
They really have the dreamers, right? Because it has such a big ambition to do good and like to, you know, think global, it attracts these type of people,
mm-hmm.
right? So the other question is like, you know, when you come in and you see like it can be like slow moving, a lot of regulation, right? It can be disheartening to some, but I think on both sides, it's the amount of dreamers is the same, which is actually the cool thing about it, right? You go from one world to the other where you get inspired by the devotion and, you know, the people that really try to make a change, at least small one, and that helps you to, you know, continue move along.
So if the space workers and the UN workers are the dreamers, who are the startupists?
The workers.
The workers. One more final question that I'm bound to ask. What is the weirdest food you've ever eaten?
It's a funny thing. I would say it's, and how do you say morche?
Oh, guinea pig.
Guinea pig in Peru. Pig.
Yeah. South Park didn't teach you never eat your guinea pig. Thank you, Mark, so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.